Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Our topic for tonight is the corner store creating community. Large corporations increasingly dominate U.S. food production. Walmart, with more than $145 billion in sales, is the nation's largest grocer. On average, farmers get back less than 20 cents of every dollar paid by the consumer, with the balance going primarily to processors, wholesalers, and retailers. What if that money stayed in local communities? What if every time you ate, you could support a local business, farmer, restaurant, a living wage, and your community's health? And what if where you bought food could right a seriously flawed food system? Well, tonight, we discuss how. Our guests are Bay Area independent grocers and entrepreneurs who historically have and continue to find ways to nourish and educate their communities about building and sustaining the community ecosystem. What business models are working and what's changing? And why is where you buy food as intimate as eating it? Joining me in studio to answer these questions and more are Bram Amadi. He is a social entrepreneur working to build healthier and more equitable inner city communities by creating food enterprises that increase access to healthy foods and foster community building. He is a co-founder of People's Grocery, a nonprofit, and the founder of People's Community Market, a fresh food retail business model for West Oakland. And Bram is a food and community fellow at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy and a fellow at Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Is that right, Bram?
Yes, it is.
Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
And welcome back. You were here with us a couple years ago.
That's right.
We also have Sam O'Ganim. He is a chef who reopened Buy Right Market in San Francisco's Mission District in 1998 in the space his family had operated since 1964. And since then, he's opened Buy Right Creamery, founded 18 Reasons, a community education space, and tilled ground on Buy Right's own Sonoma Farms. And Sam co-authored Buy Right Market's Eat Good Food, a grocer's guide to shopping, cooking, and creating community through food. And he volunteers on the board of directors for the National Association of the Specialty Food Trade for the Good Food Awards and the Community Alliance with Family Farmers. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks for having me, Lauren. Mm-hmm.
And last we have Bill Fujimoto, and he was an owner and operator of the independent produce retailer, Montgomery Market in Berkeley for more than 30 years.
Monterey Market,
thank you. Mm-hmm. And he has served as a consultant and advocate for chefs, including Alice Waters, farmers, scholars, and distributors around the world on topics such as sustainable agriculture, local farming practices, and the globalization of food. And he was a U.S. delegate at the International Slow Food Conference in Turin, Italy, and a founding member of the San Francisco Ferry Plaza Market Collaborative. And in 2009, Bill left his family's business and established Bill Fujimoto Consulting. And he holds a degree in mechanical engineering from the University of California at Berkeley. Wow.
Nice.
Welcome, Bill.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And of course, we'll be taking calls from you starting in about 20 minutes. So give us a call at 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So you all have been in this business for a long time. Let's start the show by looking back at the history of the grocery store here in California. Bill Fujimoto, why don't we start with you? Your family has been in a grocery business, I guess, starting in Oakland and then in Berkeley since the 1940s. What was it like back then in the East Bay, and how has it changed?
Well actually, my parents were in the produce business primarily.
But how is that different than grocer?
Well, groceries are cans and bottles and milk and
interesting clarification.
Talking mostly about fresh fruits and vegetables. But to point, in the 50s, you still got there were many independents. Distribution came through the wholesale markets. Independent farmers brought their produce to market at 4 o'clock in the morning or some ungodly hour, and there was a lot of direct deliveries. Produce was actually a local industry, and things like oranges were shipped across country, and lettuce and things like that. But to point, everything came within a trucking distance. Everything was originated within a trucking distance of wherever your market was. This is probably all over the country that the model was the same. So in my very young youth, I recall I used to see very many farmers at farmers markets and places like that. Sometime in the 60s, the markets became the supermarkets came up, and all of a sudden there were only four kinds of apples or five kinds of apples and three kinds of peaches, and apples were either red, yellow, or green. This is what happened. And supermarkets became the one-stop shopping. You went in your car, you bought things for a week, and that was the beginning of the demise stores were generally within the 10,000-15,000 square foot range. Now a good supermarket is 100 yeah. is 50 or 60,000 square foot for a supermarket is moderate.
So in the 70s and 80s in the East Bay, did it, was that when you started seeing independent farmers disappear, or was there still in the 60s? Did you have both the supermarket and the independent?
Yeah, there are many
stores?
Independents. The wholesale markets were very vibrant into the 60s. But once the economies of scale, distribution, small farms started to disappear, it became very difficult to exist under this, and just the way retail was going.
So where did all these little grocers go, or these little mom and pop shops go? Did they just disappear, or did these people sell out to the bigger grocers?
No, there's no model for a big store to take over a small store. They just disappeared.
Okay.
Into chains.
And that was, this happening all, I know, you were in San Francisco, Sam, was that what was happening in San Francisco too, or was it more in this, in the suburbs at this kind of growth?
San Francisco is definitely different. You didn't have as many large supermarket spaces, whereas you had a network of corner stores, really. You had smaller neighborhood markets. And, when Buyright, my family's business was first built in 1940, I mean, that was the typical size. It was, somewhere in that 2,500 to 4,000 square foot space that met the needs of a community that was within a walk. And they worked and they thrived. And there was, larger markets scattered throughout the city, but not a deep concentration. And it isn't really until the last, 15, 20 years that there's been a buildup of supermarkets in the city. Unfortunately, what it's done is it's, taken people out off the streets and put them in cars and has gotten them to drive to these anonymous spaces where they can't build a relationship with anybody.
Right.
And they lost that relationship with their butcher, and they lost that relationship with their produce buyer, and they lost that relationship, that direct link to where their food source was coming from.
So with Buyright, did people just go to their neighborhood store? Buyright was fantastic for, I don't know, apples, but were there would people go to another neighborhood store because they had a reputation for having the best butcher, or would they really stick to their neighborhood?
I think each neighborhood was different. Each neighborhood had a very different fabric. You could still see kind of remnants of them where there might be little commercial strips where there was a butcher and a bakery and a greengrocer and a produce market, amongst other retail shops in a commercial district, and that created the fabric of the shopping life for the resident in that neighborhood. Buyright, in its heyday, in that 40s and 50s period, actually was a full service market. You could go get your meats, you could get your produce, you could get your groceries and your dairy, all within one shop. And then as people started supporting the larger supermarkets, the Buyrights kind of, like my father's store, when they took it over, they had everything, and they They stopped selling like the complicated products because they were competing against these supermarkets, and it became a bodega. And that really happened to a lot of stores in San Francisco. They started selling, you know, shelf-stable products, things that didn't need as much attention and work, that weren't as perishable, that were easier to care for, really, and lost market share. And when I took over, I brought it back, you know, literally gutted the store and brought back the fresh product because that's what I wanted to.
You wanted to do. Well, we'll get back to that. Yeah. But let me bring Brahm into the story. You know, you have been working in the inner city, in a very sort of poor area, West Oakland. I'm guessing they had their own story of, you know, what's happened to the corner store. And
sure.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, it's similar, really, to all these other communities that both Bill and Sam have described in terms of some of those broader trends that existed, I would characterize as, for the most part, either before the war or really beginning to emerge after the war.
Okay,
war
can you II. Tell us a little bit about that?
So, you know, obviously I wasn't there back in those days.
Sure.
But I talked to a lot of elders in the West Oakland neighborhood who were and can really tell the stories of what the neighborhood was like. And, you know, it's important to also say that West Oakland's story represents or is similar to hundreds of other communities throughout the United States that are in present day in the same condition, where today they don't have a full-service grocery store or even a quality neighborhood grocery store, but 50 years ago very much had the same characteristics, which was the small corner store that was an authentic food retailer, a quality, fresh food-focused retailer. You know, at that time, West Oakland was extremely culturally diverse. You had European immigrants, Irish, Italian, Polish. You had Mexican and Central American immigrants. And then, of course, you had African Americans from the South. So you had this extreme diversity, and you had all kinds of different neighborhood grocers to serve those different cultural groups. So you had grocers that were very much committed to certain cultural food traditions and certain sort of ways of engaging those different communities. And then what really began to happen first was, as a lot of the working class families that moved there for the jobs in the port of Oakland or the railroads and other industries in that area began to, you know, go into the middle class, you started to see more and more consolidation in the community. So you started to get some chain stores. Safeway was actually headquartered in Oakland for a long time. And so you started to see what today would be considered a very small footprint for a Safeway. You did see that in West Oakland, right on San Pablo and 27th. Now the Olivet Church was a Safeway a long time ago. In fact, another one right down six blocks south on Grand and San Pablo, now St. Vincent de Paul, used to also be a Safeway back in the day. And so you had these sort of smaller footprints of the chain stores emerging. And then I really see it as post-World War II, things kicked into high gear on two fronts. One, you had the emergence of the suburb. You know, folks were coming back with GI Bills and sort of a lot of support from the government to buy single-family homes. And you had public-subsidized infrastructural projects to build freeways and all these kinds of things. So you had this massive population shift where all these now middle-class families left the inner city areas and moved to these new suburbs. And then these chain stores saw the opportunity, first of all, to follow that shift into new markets. But what those markets really facilitated and what began to really emerge, particularly in the 1950s, was the supermarket model. Because now you had huge, cheap, available land in these new suburban communities to build not only big footprint retail stores, but huge parking lots, because it was also a new car-oriented culture and lifestyle. You know, before the war, most families didn't own a car. After the war, you pretty much did, unless you lived in New York City or San Francisco or something like that. And so what that resulted in was a implosion, essentially, of both the local economy in a place like West Oakland, because the families who were left were the lower-income families, or they were African-American families who were of middle-class status, but because of racial policy at the time, were locked out of being able to move into these new suburbs where you had, you know, racist city councils and homeowners associations and what have you saying, sorry, you can't buy a home in our new suburb. And so with the majority of the sort of jobs and the economic base leaving, and then the supermarkets following, or the predecessors of the supermarkets following, you ended up with both concentrated lower-income communities and no food access in them as
well. So you'd think that the local, you know, those local mom and pop, you know, corner grocery stores would then there'd be a resurgence of them since there was, but there wasn't. Or
no, I think both Bill and Sam have touched on it. Bill's point being a lot of them just disappeared. They got absorbed or they got put out of business by this changing competitive environment. And then, to Sam's point, a lot of them switched their businesses over to the bodega format, really went with the products that were, frankly, more consistent with an impoverished community that has lost access to the education, to the disposable income, and to the sort of cultural fabric of their communities that would connect them to those traditional perishable foods. And with that loss, became very susceptible to the sort of national marketing of these products that we're all very familiar with today, the shelf-stable products and the national brands.
Okay.
And thus, the result is pretty much just corner stores, but the modern version of corner stores, which is nothing like what we, you know, are talking about back in those
back
times.
Back in the day. Yeah. Well, so fast forward to today, and, you know, Sam, maybe you can help us understand there's lots of different models now. I mean, we do have the giant supermarket. We have that. We have the little corner store, and then there's a lot in between. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe take us through what, you know, what the landscape looks like today?
Yeah, sure. You know, I see about five basic categories. There's the national supermarket model, like the Walmarts and the Safeways of the world, publicly held. The management team is beholden to the shareholders and so board of directors to be profitable. And that's their number one priority. I mean, if they're not profitable, they can be sued. If they don't make profit, they're number one. They're often not working with the local communities because they've got these vast global networks to source all their product. And so very little of the money stays within the local economy. Then you've got kind of a natural food subset, like the Whole Foods and the Trader Joe's of the world that have values. They're definitely doing a better job of balancing the need of all the stakeholders. You know, and the stakeholders that I've kind of identified are the customers, your suppliers, which include all your farmers and ranchers and distributors, your staff, the environment. And in the situation with these national corporations, the shareholder. So it's those five. Ultimately, both of these models do have to operate with the main goal of making money and to return on the investment for the shareholders and to make Wall Street happy. And then you've got, you know, these independently owned supermarkets. They're based regionally. They're privately held. They're competing against these chain markets, and so consequently they have to compromise some of their values in order to survive, but they tend to be more genuinely integrated into the local community. They care more about their customers and staff. They definitely seek out local suppliers and are trying to build long-term relationships with them. And then you've got the independent natural food retailers.
And how are those different than the local suppliers that you talked about before?
Say again.
The natural food versus the independent. Like, how are the two independents different?
The independents can, you know, depending on whether they've got a natural bent or not. Well, that would be the independent natural food retailer. The regional independent-owned supermarkets are not much different from like the national chains. They're working like on what Brahm says, working with the brands, the products that are nationally recognized, that are easy to get, that they can buy from like one large supplier, so that they're not having to work with hundreds of vendors. It's really about efficiency.
Okay. So it's kind of what the corner store that.
Yeah, but on a much larger scale. I mean, you know, these are still like 30,000 to 50,000 square foot stores.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, these are supermarkets.
Supermarkets. Yeah, you're still talking about all the supermarkets.
They're just not national chains.
Gotcha.
Some of them are striving to be national.
Right. Okay. Some of them do want to be. And then there's like little independent natural food retailers, and they can be small, like Byright. You know, I'd put Byright into this category, up to, you know, also 50,000 square feet. But they're definitely more values driven. They are a triple bottom line business. They care about everybody. They care about balancing the needs of all their stakeholders, and they're about building long term sustainable relationships. Devote time and energy and resources into deeply embedding themselves and integrating into the community. They work to educate. as well as to sell food and to feed people, and consequently a much larger percentage of their spend, of these companies' spend, stays in the local economy. And then you've got, you know, the corner store, single operator, very small staff, if any. They exist as a convenience and as a kind of an infill for the large shopping trip to the other resources for food, for the customer. They're very little focus on fresh. Tend to, you know, support the national chains because, again, they're easily accessible and can come direct to them. They don't have to do much work to source the product. Brahm's working on another model that I love. It's kind of a hybrid of all of these, where he's actually getting members of the community to directly invest into the business, which, you know, really creates a stake for them to shop at the market. It also creates a tremendous amount of goodwill for him to feed them and to keep them healthy and to employ them and to really build a strong, united community.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions, and tonight we're discussing the evolution of the corner store and grocer and asking the question, can it create community and how? And joining me are Brahm Amati, who's the founder of the People's Community Market, a fresh food retail business model for the inner city neighborhood of West Oakland. Bill Fujimoto, a former owner and operator of the independent produce retailer Monterey Market, and now head of Bill Fujimoto Consulting. And Sam Moganen, who's the chef and founder of By Right Family Businesses and the author of By Right Markets Eat Good Food, A Grocer's Guide to Shopping, Cooking, and Creating Community Through Food. If you'd like to join us, here is the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. You can also post a comment on the City Visions page on KALW.org or our Facebook page. But we want to know, where do you shop and why? Again, our number is 415-841-4134, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, you know, clearly there's pros and cons with these different store models. But I guess, you know, tonight we want to focus on the models that you all are working with. And I guess the first question I would have to each of you is, and maybe, you know, Bill, we'll start out with you, you know, thinking about Monterey Market and also your consulting, is how do you compete, or, you know, do you have, you know, how can you compete with these big grocery store chains? What do you tell people if you have an idea, like By Right, you know, where you have, you know, wonderful ideas, you know, you want to be a local, you want to serve the community, but people are willing to get in their car and drive for a lower price.
Well, to point, as Brahm said, these supermarkets were set up to service, to celebrate the economies of scale, and also with the when suburbs were first created, they were socialists. That is, there is no cultural identity with any of these, and so the supermarkets created their own created their social identity, their culture, and so each supermarket chain has its own culture. But since it's a chain, it may or may not have anything to do with the neighborhood you're putting the store into. We were just talking about Fresh and Easy. I guess we can use a name like that. But how they were just they're just dropped into a neighborhood, and there's, whereas an independent, you know, and so how do you compete? As it turns out, it may not be that hard. It isn't that hard. You by culturally identifying with your neighborhood, by serving the neighborhood as a cultural community, you can actually target what, you know, offer people what they want and celebrate who they are. And by doing that, you establish that kind of connection.
Now, Sam, you kind of turned your parents' market around and sort of changed the feel, added a lot of different unique elements. Were you ever worried that you were pitching something that wouldn't resonate with the neighborhood? I mean, the mission is, I don't know if I were just told that this is the kind of market you're putting in the mission, I might think, you know, maybe that should be in Presidio or some, yeah. You know, more affluent.
I mean, it's a great question that everyone always asks me.
You know,
they, can you just pick up Byright and put it into any other neighborhood and make it work? You know, and Byright, you know, 15 years ago when we started, it was very different than it is today.
Yeah. Can you talk about that for people that aren't familiar with the story?
I mean, when we first opened, a lot of the basic tenants were there. I mean, there was definitely a focus on freshness. There was a focus on great ingredients. You know, as a chef, I wanted, you know, people to be able to buy the same ingredients that I was used to cooking. And I wanted to teach them how to use them and how to cook them so they can, you know, go home and make amazing meals. But we didn't have as strong of a commitment to sustainability and to organics. We didn't have as many products. And as, you know, we even had some of the, you know, we used to sell like Kellogg's Corn Flakes and Cheerios when we first opened. And as we built relationships within the neighborhood, and as we built with our customers, and as we built more relationships with farmers and ranchers, and as we integrated and got more rooted into where we were, we evolved, and a lot of that evolution was driven by our own desire, but a lot of it was also driven by our customers. They came in requesting things and asking us to bring new things in and change things and calling us out on product that we had. And, you know, we refined it, and we keep refining it, and it continues to evolve today.
So it sounds like it really wasn't that you had this vision that you plopped in, but it really, you took into account what people, and you sort of evolved.
I think the vision was there, but we didn't go in and composing this dogma.
Right.
We went in there ready to listen and ready to serve, and I think that any good business should do that, you know, and I think that's like one of the most important distinctions between an independent and a national corporation is that there really isn't somebody there who cares. There isn't somebody there who's going to listen and respond.
Interesting. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer. And tonight we're discussing the evolution of the corner store, if you will. And joining me tonight are Bram Amadi, who's the founder of People's Community Market, a fresh food retail business model for the inner city neighborhood of West Oakland. Bill Fujimoto, who's a former owner and operator of the independent produce retailer Monterey Market and now head of Bill Fujimoto Consulting. And Sam Moganim, who's the chef and founder of Byright Family Businesses and author of Byright Markets Eat Good Food, a grocer's guide to shopping, cooking, and creating community through food. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I'm curious how you feel about the store near you. Does it seem to satisfy your needs, or do you wish it was like, Sam was talking about or Bill was alluding to? Give us a call and let us know. Let me take our first caller for the evening. We have Olivia. Olivia is from Oakland. Welcome to City Visions, Olivia.
Hi. I'm old, and I want to put in a viewpoint from, like, the 1950s.
Uh-huh. Sure.
When my mother used to... I grew up in Minneapolis. We lived in an ordinary middle-class neighborhood. The grocery stores, the little stores still existed then. In the 50s, my mother would walk up to four blocks or five blocks, and there was a butcher and there was a baker, you know, every door. Mm-hmm. And then she would carry everything home for four people. And that was heavy, and it took a lot of time. And when, you know, there are other various reasons why the big stores have succeeded, but one is it's labor saving for people and time saving. You can go, I mean, actually, I shop at Berkeley Natural Grocery, mainly in Berkeley, which is a small store, but because I find Whole Foods too commercial. So I'm with you on, you know, the basic values, but I want to put that in being able to drive to a store and not have to carry everything home for many of us is a huge advantage.
Uh-huh.
So that's really my main point.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that, Olivia. Really appreciate your calling in.
I have a comment
to
that.
Bill. I mean, I'm sorry, Sam.
You know, it's interesting. You know, Bayreuth's, you know, in the middle of a block with no parking. And when we first opened, many people thought it was crazy. You know, how can you have a grocery store without parking? And you know, one of our visions was to teach people to hopefully inspire people to shop on a daily, every other day basis. And it's really cool to see people coming in and buying the food that they need for the day or for the next day, and walking away with just one bag, you know, instead of the trunk load that you typically would have done in the past. Yeah.
From. Do you want to add?
Yeah, I think another important perspective from the work that I do,
yes,
in West Oakland and other lower income neighborhoods is a lot of people don't have the privilege of having a car.
Sure.
In West Oakland, about half of the households don't own a vehicle. So they do rely on the walking, and they rely on public transportation. They walk to the corner stores, which we've already described in terms of what those options are, or they have to go through all of the hassle and the time and cost of getting to a far-out supermarket outside of their community. So what we're trying to do in creating People's Community Market is to really bring the same model that Sam has demonstrated in the mission, which is the walkability for, not for everyone, and I understand the caller's point, but for a growing segment of people is a really good solution for their basic needs. Now, in our case, we're not trying to compete in certain areas that someone probably is going to get in a car and drive to a Walmart or drive to a Costco. We know where our strengths can be. But in certain categories, the independent grocers, like Bill described, can really customize and serve that specific cultural and demographic neighborhood in a way that no one else can. And when you blend that with the walkable attributes, you start to create this model that creates a certain kind of convenience because the product mix is increasingly refined and increasingly honed to that specific neighborhood, and it begins to fill out the basket of that customer group. Will it, again, like Sam said, work in another neighborhood? Probably not. You're talking about a different set of cultural mixes and people and interests and what have you. But what we found is that kind of the opposite trend in a neighborhood like West Oakland, where people want to be able to walk. And right now they can't, and that's a real point of challenge for them, again, because so many don't own a car and either have to take a bus. Some actually will do a taxi the other way home, and you know that can be very expensive.
Well, so. What are your biggest priorities when you think about your neighborhood and the West Oakland neighborhood and creating this new market? No, it's not up and running yet, right?
No, it's not yet open. This is coming out of a nonprofit, as you mentioned, called People's Grocery that I co-founded in 2002 and was the director of for 8 years. And the business, People's Community Market, is essentially building off of the nonprofit's base building in the community, running a handful of smaller food enterprises, including a project we called the Mobile Market. We took an old postal truck and turned it into a small grocery store and rolled through the neighborhood 3 days a week. And just sort of taking all the knowledge and insights and understanding from those years of doing that work and the feedback from the community to try to create this business model. Certainly addressing the biggest gaps in the neighborhood, in the fresh foods, uh-huh, in the produce, in uh-huh, the perishable foods is the main focus. Another one is really trying to understand what is the fill-in cycles. What are those items that residents do consume every couple of days that we can compete in and we can bring into the store and do it, you know, in a good quality way. And then also, actually, West Oakland is extremely underserved in the prepared foods, and we want to do something similar. Sam has done as a chef, is really excel in the prepared foods area as well and bring quality, culturally oriented quality hot foods back to the neighborhood.
And can you do that at the price point that the West Oakland neighborhood could afford?
We believe we can. Our goal is not to be the cheapest game in town. We'll lose at that game just like any other small grocer does. Because we don't have the scale and the purchasing power that those chain stores do. But one of the advantages that independent grocers have is a lot of flexibility and creativity in how you source and how you work with your suppliers and the promotional schemes that you put in place in your store. And so we're looking at a lot of those kinds of strategies as ways to sort of leverage those advantages to make sure that our prices are affordable.
Let me go to another caller. We have Jonathan. Good evening, Jonathan.
Hi.
And Jonathan, you're from San Francisco.
I just wanted to put in I've been shopping for about 40 years from Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco. It's a worker-owned cooperative. And they do have maps to show the local, the areas where the food comes from, you know. And they really push for locally grown stuff.
And Jonathan, do you live near Rainbow, or do you go there?
I go there by bus. Okay. In San Francisco, I don't drive. I mean, I gave up driving 50 years ago, and we do have a little bit of public transportation left here.
And where do you live?
In San Francisco, in the Tenderloin in the Tenderloin. San Francisco. And, you know, there was a big push in the 70s of Wells Fargo to buy out the Central Valley farmers and all, and then they raised their rates and foreclosed on them. I don't know.
Okay.
About that. Okay.
Well, thank you for sharing. So, you know, let me ask, you know, Bill, the co-op model, I mean, do a lot of people you work with ask about that, or what do you think about that?
I'm really not familiar that much because I've always been a commercial retailer. But to these other points, you know, I just want to tell you that the markets, independent markets, can be successful because they are part of the community that they serve, and that is the last caller who goes to Rainbow. He goes to Rainbow because that's his community. When in the store I used to work at in Berkeley, there was an independent meat market, an independent fish market, an independent deli, a bakery, and people would park and hike around. I mean, we're not to the woman's point, you can't walk to your, you know, in this day and age, you can't always walk to everything, but it's the community. The point is the community that a supermarket actually has trouble creating because there's a central directive to create for the personality of the store. And but in terms of co-ops, co-ops have by having participation, your employees
creating a community
are part of that community. Mm-hmm. You know, you can run as an independent business owner, you try to always empower your employees.
Have you do you have something to add to that, Ron?
I do. I've been involved on and off with co-ops. In fact, I had a pretty good relationship with Rainbow Grocery over the years. Was a co-founder of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. And we are moving in the direction of not creating a cooperative, but an employee-owned business. And the primary difference being there's a core principle in the cooperative business model where you have a one-member, one-vote policy. And we've chosen for different reasons not to use that particular practice. But our goal is to become employee-owned in the long term. And the reason is that we believe that that creates the same kind of loyalty from your employees that you're working always to create with your customers.
Sure.
As well, when employees feel that they have a meaningful stake, that they have an opportunity to contribute to the business beyond their shift and beyond their wage, which also means they may have the opportunity eventually, assuming there's profit sharing, to benefit from those contributions, our feeling is that increases the business overall. And a lot of supermarkets will say that, well, the reason we don't open in a low-income neighborhood is the employee problems are such a headache, you know, the turnover and, you know, the lack of job history and sort of all the sort of challenges of working with a workforce that may not have that stability that supermarkets really prefer. What we found is that when you're at that community level and you can really engage and you can understand what those challenges are, and then you can build partnerships to help train your workforce, and then on top of that, give them a meaningful stake and a sort of where they can see a path of where they can potentially go in this business, one that's never been presented to them before in terms of there's an opportunity here for you to be here a long time and to rise in this business and to make profit sharing from the stake you have in the business in addition to your wage. We believe, and of course we're setting up to test this, that resolves that problem that the supermarkets, you know, often blame is why they won't open.
Okay, let me go to take a different caller. We have a Joe from San Francisco.
Hi,
Joe.
Hello. Thank you for letting me come on, too. I support the gentleman before me very much on Rainbow, and I will just add that I'm an elderly woman that shops very regularly at Rainbow, and I'm clear up near Polk and Broadway. And I managed to get, I have several buses that I can select from and go there regularly. And I go there because it is co-op and their veggies, their integrity for organic and really healthy organic food and local is wonderful. and I won't go any further. I'll let it go. But I just want to really emphasize Rainbow is very, very special, and I've been going there over 20 years.
Okay. Well, right. So again, it's
Rainbow.
Well,
I was just shopping there Sunday.
That was Sam from Buy Right saying that. So Sam, I mean, are there aspects of Rainbow? It sounds like, Rainbow seems to resonate with a lot of the similar ways that you've tried to do with Buy Right. Do you find that you've stolen business from Rainbow or that no. It's a totally different customer?
It's, we share a lot of customers. It's, it's pretty awesome. We send people to Rainbow all the time and Rainbow staff send people to our store all the time. Anytime one of their guests asks for a good place to go get a protein meat, because it's a vegetarian store, we're the first place on the list that they recommend. So, I think Rainbow is one of the most special stores in the country. I also think the same of Buy Right.
Yeah.
Can I just make a comment on
kind of
bigger observation that I've had coming into this work? I'm an aspiring grocer, not yet a grocer.
Okay.
Obviously, we're working to open. But sort of looking at the local markets and industry, I've seen this dynamic that Sam just touched on, which is independents and community grocers don't have the same kind of competitive, scarcity, kind of closed-off mindset that you see in the larger chains. Those chains are in such a different paradigm around competition and sort of fighting for scraps of market share and, slightly moving the meter on their stock value, one day to the next, that's really the world they're entrenched in. I've found time and time again, and, I've managed to build a lot of support from guys like Bill and Sam, that competitiveness and that sense of threat isn't really the same. There's a much more collaboration and goodwill or at a minimum, a genuine support to see each other succeed.
Now,
and I think that's unique.
But do you think that'd be true if you were talking to the person across the street and trying to establish a new shop?
That's a hyper-local example that I can't really say I'm familiar with. But certainly, in a city or even in a neighborhood where there's a large enough market, and I'll use West Oakland as an example of this. It's a community of about 25,000 people. They collectively spend about $60 million a year on groceries. They're underserved by about 70% of that, which means over $40 million of their grocery spending goes out of the neighborhood and goes to all these other surrounding stores and other parts of the city. Point being that multiple small grocers could make it in West Oakland at that size of a market very easily without being very much in direct threat or competition with each other. I think it's the mindset about not just the market and the size of the market, but, the ability to differentiate. If you know Buy Right and you know Rainbow, there are some overlaps and there are some fundamentally different things about their businesses as well. And both businesses know what those strengths are.
That's fantastic. If you're just joining us, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the evolution of the grocer corner store. Joining me are Bram Ahmadi, founder of People's Community Market, a fresh food retail business model for the inner city neighborhood of West Oakland, Bill Fujimoto, former owner and operator of the independent produce retailer Monterey Market, and now head of Bill Fujimoto Consulting, and Sam McGauman, who's the chef and founder of Buy Right Family Businesses and author of Buy Right Markets Eat Good Food, a grocer's guide to shopping, cooking, and creating community through food. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And we'd love to hear from you. We've had some great callers about your experience shopping, buying produce, and how you decide where you're going to go. It seems like there's room for everyone and some especially innovative models. Let me go to Catherine from Sebastopol. She's been holding on. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for all these gentlemen and women creating this local network. It sounds like they've really got the idea of bringing it back local, and I applaud their uptake of organic, the idea of naturalism hijacked by big corporate. It doesn't mean same as organic, so that's another last mile that really, but it's great to see a community, rebuild itself with. I live in an area where there's a lot of farmers markets, and actually I moved in the last year, and I looked for areas that had farmers markets first.
Okay.
Around those, they are magnificent. They have, in California, some of the most beautiful food in the world. And it just shocks me that people still buy from big chains, you know, with such gorgeous local organic food. And, you know, the GMO problem hasn't come up, but it's a huge, huge elephant in the room where we've got, you know, big corporations taking over our food supply and our food safety. And what is food? I mean, it's genetically modified, a whole bunch of things in. So I wish we'd talk about that a lot
okay,
more.
Okay, that's a really good point that hasn't come across our conversation. Bill, how are people in the produce area dealing with GMOs right now? I know we didn't pass. You know that you didn't pass.
My gosh, what a labeling! What a big question.
or do you, maybe you could comment? On
yeah.
What
well,
Catherine
well,
calls.
To point to do if you want to be funded for new studies new plant varieties, genetics, plant genetics, it has to be GMO. That's the only way you'll get any money.
Okay.
But to point genetically modified seeds and everything. It's a way to monetize seed, and that it's leading to a drop in diversity. There's no question about it. You know, you can talk about all the improvements. You know, if they were saving humanity quickly, you know, that would be one thing. But right now, we have. Right now, we have six corporations which own all the seed, 75% of the seed in this world. Mm-hmm. And so, I just don't. The three of us are always looking for the best tasting, the best flavor, not the cheapest, not the most efficiently produced, mm-hmm. but the most carefully produced, the most sustainably produced. You know, things that are intrinsically good. Probably the best tool to create those products are genetically is to use GMO, but I don't think there's anything wrong with labeling it as such.
Yeah. Well, no, Sam.
To speak about the dangers, I can't speak to the dangers of it. But,
sure.
You know, I'm just saying that what it's leading to is a drop in diversity.
Well, do you, like Sam, for your clientele, and I guess I'll ask you too, Brahm, I mean, is that something you worry about as you're trying to source things?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, our business, you know, Bio-Rite's entire model is built on relationships, and any fundamental relationship is built on a foundation of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's one of the key tenets for how we manage and run our business and really create our community. And one of the biggest challenges with the GMO issue is that there are GM ingredients in almost, you know, like 70% of the products in a typical supermarket. It's everywhere, and nobody really knows where. And it's contaminating lots of non-GM fields. And so for somebody like me, when I'm looking at a product and I see, you know, soy lecithin in a chocolate bar, you know, and if it's not labeled non-GMO, my first inkling is that, you know, 85% of the soy grown in this country is genetically modified. It's likely containing a contaminated ingredient. And so I opt not to buy it, but it's a full-time job. You know, it's a full-time job for lots of people to keep up with it and to keep filtering it out. And it's just getting harder and harder. You know, I know we're not going to be able to get rid of GMOs, but we definitely need to do something about making sure that people understand more about them, and at a minimum know that the food that they're buying, the food that they're feeding their kids, contains it.
Well, we get an email from Jessica from Berkeley. She says, Brahm, I love you. And thanks for the race and class analysis. Bill and Sam, you are great. There's a story today about the four biggest food stories of the year: Twinkies, Prop 37, tuna scrape, and meat byproducts in our food, and the toxic environment. Any comment on this, or what do you think the food story of the year is? So, any thoughts on that, Brahm?
Well, you know, I work in a very specific sort of vein of food issues specific to underserved neighborhoods, and I think the biggest food story that's just broken, and it will continue into 2013, and Bill touched on it earlier, is the demise of the Fresh and Easy chain. which is a subsidiary of Tesco, the third largest retailer in the world, that made an entrance into the U.S. market in 2007 with an extremely ambitious goal of opening essentially thousands of stores in a 10-year period, and was very unsuccessful in doing that or even becoming profitable at all. But nonetheless, and the reason it is a big story for me, did open as one of the few chain stores that actually did open grocery stores, supermarkets in lower-income neighborhoods. Right here in San Francisco, they opened one in the Baby Hunters Point neighborhood, which had not had a supermarket or a grocery store for decades. Similarly, in Los Angeles, I grew up down south, in South Central L.A., after years of city officials and community-based organizations and church coalitions working, they were able to get a Fresh and Easy to open. Now Fresh and Easy is closing. They're going out of business. The CEO was fired last week. The parent company has declared they are shutting the operation down. And for many of the, you know, other hundreds of communities that were relatively well-served, have a large market with a lot of different operators in them, they won't feel this in terms of being a devastating event. But for a dozen, maybe two dozen communities throughout the Western region, which is where this chain has operated, they're going to lose their store. And they're going to be kind of back to where they were again, which is without one. And to me, the main reason it's the big story is it really underscores much of the points that we're making tonight, that at the end of the day, the big chains are publicly held companies that face enormous pressures to make profit-maximizing decisions. And those are unfortunately often at the odds of communities. And so I think that what I'm hopeful is that this story is going to result in some questioning of that premise in the future.
Interesting. Sam, what about you? What do you think of that? Would you agree that with Rahm's big story, or what would you say?
I definitely agree that the demise of Fresh and Easy is a huge story. You know, Prop 37 and the Right to Know campaign for labeling GMO ingredients, I think, was another huge story. But the story hasn't been publicized as dramatically as either of those, that I think is going to become more pertinent in the coming year or two, is our responsibility to reducing our waste. We as a nation, waste 40% of the food that we produce, and if you think about all the resources that go into all that food and all the energy, and the number of people that can actually be fed, with that food, it's going, with the reduction in our resources and the reduction in the amount of money and the increase in population, we're going to have to do something dramatic about it. Otherwise, we're going to get worse and worse.
That sounds like another nonprofit for you, Rahm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bill, do you think along the same lines? Or
I really, just in terms of food safety, of food safety, producing, economies of scale, just cross over that line so many times into food safety, and the stories that abound that will continue.
Pink slime.
Well, pink slime is just part of the, it's just more economies of scale. I don't know that there's a story, but...
Peanut butter.
Well, yeah, peanut butter. So let's go back to the whole, local and community. So, each of you in your own way have been trying to work with that. Maybe we're coming to the top of the hour, but I'd love to, give you a little chance to talk about what your stores, or Monterey Market, or consulting, in your case, Bill, have been doing for the community, and what people can look forward to going forward. Bill, why don't we start with you?
My premise is you try to deliver products that are intrinsically good, culturally matching the customers you serve. And it's runs counter to supermarkets, because they're trying to serve you what they can serve up economically. And quite honestly, by using that premise, you're trying to bring a wholesomeness and an opinion to your retail market, then in doing so, you actually have this responsibility of sourcing, and you will end up, in fact, being local. You will be local because you need to have that traceability. You need to have that familiarity with not seeing a ubiquitous bag of lettuce from a huge corporation. Instead, you'll have some traceability, you'll have some familiarity with the product, you'll be able to stand behind it. And I'm not talking about me, but my employees, sure, staff, and organizations. And if you expand that one little concept, it turns into a very nice,
and do you think that the
comfortable community market,
the food safety goes away when you, or more it, or less,
it'll never go. Food safety never goes away, but you have that traceability. Sure. You have that traceability and reliance on sources that you're familiar with. And at some point, for food safety, the reason for that you have to have so much food safety is because of the distribution of product nowadays.
Sure, makes sense.
5 states, 10 states.
Okay, and what about you, Sam? What do you think in terms of thinking about BuyRight and community? And I mean, it must be on your mind 24/7.
It is. It's our mission, you know.
Yes.
Creating community through food is what drives everything that we do. And it's really important to me that we balance all the needs of our stakeholders and our community. You know, our customers, our staff, our suppliers, and the environment. And the minute that one of those stakeholders is given more priority than the other, the balance is lost. And we failed in succeeding in our mission. And it's, it resonates in so many ways. I mean, I think about when we first opened the market in 1998, we had 6 employees. Now we have 135
in the same
space.
Are the employees generally local neighborhood people?
Yeah, predominantly.
Yeah, I mean,
we have like less than a handful of people that drive to work. Mm-hmm. I love that. We've revitalized the block, and there's more than 400 people working on our block, and there's lots of businesses that are succeeding. And that's what a grocer can do. It can be an anchor. It can be a focal point for a community.
Excellent. Mm. And what about you, Brahm?
Well, ditto to all those points. I'll throw in a slightly different angle also that we're playing with as we design our store, which is that we think that we can also use our grocery store, in addition to being an excellent source for quality foods and really listening and serving the neighborhood and what those foods are, providing positive social space to the community as well. So we have this idea, in addition to our 12,000 square foot retail space, an additional about 3,000 square foot space called the front porch, which is basically a semi-open courtyard that has a stage, seating, and kind of patio, and a small children's play area. And the idea is, first of all, to provide a positive space to the neighborhood where folks can just come and hang out and socialize, share a meal. There's no coffee shops or anything like that in West Oakland right now. And then secondly, to offer a rich calendar of events, things like jazz night and barbecues on Sundays.
Fantastic.
And ongoing events in the community, and really build on the retailing to provide additional value and support to the neighborhood.
Wow. Well, I can't wait. 2013, is that when it's going to open?
Probably late 2013.
Okay. Well, that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Brahm Ahmadi, founder of People's Community Market, Bill Fujimoto, former owner and operator of the independent produce retailer Monterey Market, and now head of Bill Fujimoto Consulting, and Sam Aganin, chef and founder of BuyRight Family Businesses. Thank you so much to all of you. This was a fantastic show.
Thanks very much. Appreciate that.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at klw.org. Our engineers this evening were Debbie Kennedy and Eric Wayne. Thank you. And tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denenmark. Fantastic show, Lisa. Thank you very much. Susie Britton is the show's senior producer. Join City Visions next week with Joseph Pache as he speaks to San Francisco's police chief to discuss if violent crimes are on the rise in San Francisco. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thank you for listening. Good night and have a great week. Who are the